Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, my name is Ilona Thompson, Palate Exposure. We're here today in the rainy Livermore Valley with Stephen Kent Mirisu from the namesake brand Stephen Kent, and he's going to tell us all about himself, his life's journey, which is a generational affair, his brand, and Livermore Wine Country, which I think really needs to be known way better. So we'll start at the very beginning.
Tell us on that particular precept. Oh, it's nice having you here.
Thank you.
I do predict the rain will stop at some point. Hopefully within the next several months.
Yes.
It has been a wet winter so far.
Yes.
Stephen Kent Mirisu and the Mirisu family. We have been making wine. My family has been making wine in California. This is a way that I put some context on this. I'm the sixth generation of my family in the business. Mm-hmm. My son just joined the effort as my full-time assistant winemaker this past harvest, 2018.
How cool.
Which is amazing. Yes. Amazing for me.
Yes.
I've always hoped that would be the case. Like my father, who did not push me into the business, I tried not to push my son, Aiden. And he's been working at the winery doing sort of the same kinds of menial tasks that I did when I worked at the Mirisu Vineyards, my family winery, back in the 70s.
Yeah.
And he gravitated toward the production end of things, as I did. When my former assistant winemaker went to a different winery, My son said, you know what, I want to do this. So it was a beautiful surprise for me. And he leapt right in, and he's running the cellar now. So he's continuing this family tradition. Mirisu as a family is the oldest winemaking family in the country. We started making wine in San Jose 6 years before Abraham Lincoln was president. Kind of the context that I love to put around things. Seventh generation means something, but when you put that kind of context on things, it really kind of shows 164 years or whatever it is now in the wine business in California. So it's an honor. It's you know, I jokingly say, and it's probably not far from the truth, we don't know how to do anything else as a family. So it's a good thing, I think, that we make wine that people enjoy, and that we make wine, I think, that's appropriate for the place that we're in, which is one of those amazing places. It's really a not well enough discovered gem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Livermore Valley is one of the oldest wine growing areas in California. Mm-hmm. It is one of those places that gained prominence before Prohibition, really was the first great wine region in California in the 1870s and 1880s because of a lot of different things, Prohibition being a major factor, but also the choice of varieties, the choice of marketing of wine by some of the pioneer families in Livermore caused them to go in a certain direction. I think Livermore Valley, in a way, lost a little bit of that potential competitiveness, or competitive mm-hmm. edge with Napa Valley, for instance,
sure.
In the 1960s and 70s. What makes Livermore special? I think one of the things that makes Livermore special is this really is a great viticultural place. It's mm-hmm. not just that we're in the Bay Area. It's not just that people have been toiling the soil for 170 years now in this valley. It really is because the inherent quality of the place allows for, and in my opinion, demands that winemakers reach for a level of quality that's as good as any in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're not Modesto, you know, we're not in the Central Valley, we're not mm-hmm. a hot climate, we're a warm growing area. People have this misapprehension that when they go to Livermore, they're going to Modesto, that it's, you know, that it's 100 degrees at night and it's 100 degrees in the morning, and it never differs, and all you do get is heat.
Mm-hmm.
And that couldn't be further from the truth. We're about 38 miles east, slightly south of San Francisco
mm-hmm.
and the Bay. We're between Oakland and San Jose, and we're right in the middle of a ring of mountains that, mm-hmm. that extend from the bay itself mm-hmm. to the Altamont Pass and beyond. And what that allows for is all this beautiful wind to come in the afternoons and really knock daytime temperatures down dramatically. Mm-hmm. Our diurnal temperature range is huge in Livermore. Mm-hmm. That cool air drops temperatures down dramatically, helps the plants maintain acidity, fruit maintain acidity. And during the day, we get all the sunlight we need to get the sugars that we want, to get the alcohol levels that we want. And then we have this beautiful acidity balancing things out in the evening. Just to give kind of a comparison, mid-Napa Valley, sort of St. Helena, Oakville to St. Helena even, we have fewer degree days here in Livermore than they do there. Hmm. We are much cooler than Calistoga is. We're harvesting Cabernet, especially further east at Gilmetti Vineyard. We're sitting kind of what I sort of call the center of the Livermore Valley Appalachian. Mm-hmm. 3.5 miles further east is Gilmetti Vineyard, is about 1,000 feet above sea level. Mm-hmm. And this cold air that comes in from the bay really pulls up against that hill. This is one of the few valleys that's east-west oriented in California. Mm-hmm. So it really kind of just naturally draws this air in up over the Altamont Pass, but it kind of pools here for a while on top of Gilmetti Vineyard, which is our larger estate vineyard. Mm-hmm. And we're harvesting Cabernet 3 weeks after Napa's done. You know, so this idea that we're really a warm place is not correct. And that sort of Mediterranean climate we get here, coupled with a lot of rocky soil from old mm-hmm. rivers that used to run through the valley, a variety of different soil types, a variety of different microclimates, weather-wise, a lot of elevation changes, allows us to grow Bordeaux varieties as well as they can be grown. Mm-hmm. Then it's a function of people, I think, having a vision about what they want from a wine standpoint. Mm-hmm. And making sure that they farmed really well and that they don't make mistakes in the cellar. You know, they've chosen the right barrel program. They've chosen the things that will allow them to make the wines that will hopefully forge an emotional connection between them and the person who ends up drinking the wine at some point in time. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like, first of all, let's talk about how vast the valley is, and clearly the land price isn't nowhere near what they are in the Napa Valley. So right. You do have an opportunity to kind of spread your wings a little bit, experiment, right? Yeah. How did that contribute to the overall big picture?
That's a good question. You know, barrier to entry here financially is a lot lower than it is in Napa. Mm-hmm. The Appalachian contains about 90,000 acres. Mm-hmm. There are 5,000 or so planted now. So compare that to 50 to 55,000 acres planted in Napa. You know, we're 1/10 the size of that larger Appalachian. Mm-hmm. Not all those 90,000 acres are plantable.
Sure.
There's a lot of the area in the southern part of Livermore where we are mm-hmm. has been planted out already. Mm-hmm. There's room above 580, the freeway. Mm-hmm. So the northern part of the Appalachian, there's room to plant. There's room to plant further west as you get closer to San Francisco Bay. What I've seen in the 25 years that I've been here is that there is very much a generational change going on. Mm-hmm. The first people to plant and to thrive here thrived in the 1880s. The Wente family, the Concannon family, came to Livermore in 1883. Mm-hmm. They continue to be the leaders of the Appalachian in terms of volume of wine that they're making and the overall footprint that they have in the valley. Mm-hmm. And their influence in the valley. You know, mm-hmm. And that influence extends far beyond clones of Cabernet from Concannon and clones of Chardonnay from Wente.
Yeah.
They have meant a lot, especially the Wente family, in terms of helping smaller wine folks, including myself, kind of get into the valley. Mm-hmm. And they've offered infrastructure for people to use. They've offered fruit that people can buy. So they're very much a champion of the valley.
Wow.
The original pioneers kind of led to, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, folks who worked at the Livermore Lab, for instance, mm-hmm. retired,
sure.
lived in, you know, this bucolic, beautiful area, lived on some land, liked the wine lifestyle, planted some vineyards, made more wine than they could drink, figured that they got to put a shingle out in Tesla Road and sell some wine from their tasting room, which is what has happened. Mm-hmm. To varying degrees of success, I think.
Sure.
What I think has happened since from the mid-1990s onward, though, is you're starting to get people whose main income is derived from making and selling wine, kind mm-hmm. of like mm-hmm. my situation.
Sure.
You know, we're commercial winemakers, mm-hmm. and we are I think I'm probably the oldest of that group. There are a bunch of younger kids now involved, which I think brings a lot of energy to the Valley, mm-hmm. brings a lot of potential change, mostly positive, I suspect, but also potential growth, visibility for the Valley, and better quality. An opportunity to sort of learn from the past mistakes and successes here and hopefully bring those outward and mm-hmm. onward to a larger and more receptive audience.
So since we're on the subject, those that know of Napa Valley certainly would trace it back to Mandavi. That name always comes up. He is that ambassador that will, whose influence would never die. What do you think happened in Livermore with formidable families such as Concannons and Wentys, who put a tremendous amount of effort into not just the production, but also the marketing, the awareness piece of it? Why is Livermore Valley still so relatively unknown?
Gosh, I have theories. I don't know that I have answers.
Okay.
I think part of the answer is that Robert Mondavi was an absolute singular personality.
Right.
There you don't get many people like him. He would be the equivalent of a Steph Curry or somebody like that in terms of influence and sheer mm-hmm. ability. Mm-hmm. My family knew the Mondavi, still know the Mondavi family, but when my father and his cousins started marketing the Mirasu winery name in 1966, Bob Mondavi was their consultant. So Bob would come down from Napa every couple of weeks to San Jose and help these kids learn about the business. Michael Mondavi was going to a Catholic prep high school in San Jose at the time, and Bob was always the marketing guy. His family had been making wine in Napa since the 1930s, just after Prohibition ended. But Bob was always a very forward-looking person, forward-thinking mm-hmm. person, and he understands that it's a lot easier to make wine than it is to sell wine. I remember a story my father tells me. 1967, Bob has been kicked out of the family winery, and he's starting Mondavi. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather and grandmother co-signed a loan for Bob, the first loan on the Mondavi winery.
Oh my goodness, how about that little
factoid? $100,000 in 1967 was a lot of money back then.
Wow.
But Bob invited the family, the fifth and fourth generation, to go up to Napa to kind of see what was going on with the winery, see what they were doing up there. And so they all pile into a car and drive from San Jose to Napa and spend the day with Bob, and he's showing him the new winery. And they get back to San Jose, and my father told me that my great uncle turns to the younger guys, who are all in their mid-20s at this point in time, and he says, I don't know what the hell he's doing. 80% of what he's devoted there, space-wise, is to marketing, and 20% of it's to winemaking. And I think about what my family did and what my family chose to do in terms of that kind of balance of those two sides of things. And obviously, one of them was right and the other one was not so much right. And unfortunately for my family, the guy who was right was not of the family. He understood that wine is about storytelling in a lot of ways. It's about sharing. It's about, again, creating that emotional connection to people. Yeah. You can go to any store in California these days and buy any wine you want. Any price point. And if all you want is a bottle of wine for dinner, it's a perfect situation for people. But there is something I think that's very alluring about talking to people who have their hands in the dirt year after year, who get to stand over for mentors and listen and smell and taste as this transformation happens from grape juice to beautiful wine. There's something very magical and mysterious about the process. Something very romantic too. There's a lot of garbage in it as well. There's a lot of material other than grape, as we call it.
Yeah,
there's a lot of mog in the business, both from a production standpoint and from a marketing standpoint. But fundamentally, it's an amazingly beautiful thing to be involved in. And I think that from the storytelling standpoint and from the marketing side of things, there wasn't a singular voice in Livermore of the stature of Bob Mondavi. There isn't anywhere else in the world, practically. There are a few of them.
True.
Baron Philippe Rothschild, who's passed many years ago, mm-hmm. was one of those people as well. Mm-hmm. There aren't many in the world. And, you know, I think that that's part of the reason why Livermore hasn't attained a level of recognition and visibility that I think is equal to the stature of its ability to make wine as a growing region.
Sure.
I think the fact that we're, you know, some, especially when the economy is good, it's almost a bedroom community of Silicon Valley from a commuter standpoint.
Sure.
We don't exist absolutely in this bucolic place like on Highway 29 or on you know, or in Napa Valley,
mm-hmm.
You know, in the Stag's Leap area or what have you. Once you get off the freeways, though, it's beautiful in Livermore, but you do have to get off the freeway.
Yeah.
So it's not something that's as visible for people passing through as it is when you're in Napa Valley. There aren't the restaurants here yet,
mm-hmm.
growing. Much better quality than it was 5 years ago. There aren't hotels yet coming,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the next couple of years. So from an amenity standpoint, we don't give people yet the real reason to stay for more than a few hours. The wine quality is getting better. I think that there's ample reason for people to stay here for a weekend in terms of the number of wineries they can go to and have great wine and meet people like myself who are actually working in the winery all the time and there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a collegiality here that from a winemaking standpoint, business to business, that you don't get in Napa anymore, I don't think, like you used to 40 years
mm-hmm.
ago.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of work that needs to be done. You know, this area is, I think, one of the things it does extremely well is the same variety that Napa Valley has made its name on. So, you know, really, it's hard to out Napa Napa, especially when you have a whole business infrastructure built around and a criticism infrastructure built around this idea of Napa Valley Cabernet, whatever that means. And if people, well, I won't go down that road at this point in time, but there's a predisposition already for people who are interested in wine, interested in Cabernet especially,
mm-hmm.
that there is one place in California to go to. And it's definitely not true in terms of quality Cabernet, but it's very true in terms of the overall picture of what Napa offers a guest at this point in time that Livermore doesn't.
That's quite a formidable and slightly disturbing thought, because if we think about it historically, Napa once upon a time was in real danger of becoming Silicon Valley, and because of land trust activity and such, that's not what happened, thank goodness. And it is very picturesque. But if we were to dial it down strictly to geophysical conditions, land and soil, what you're describing is that there's a high degree of compatibility. I dare say that they're neck and neck. Is that an accurate perception or not?
I think so. I think there probably is more, there are more extremes in Napa than there are in Livermore in
okay.
terms of elevation. We're a bowl as mm-hmm. a valley. We're not this deep V like you get in Napa Valley.
Yeah.
Our valley floor is several hundred feet higher above sea level than Napa's
okay.
floor.
Okay.
That changes things, I think, to Livermore's advantage. I think that the cultural, the viticultural and enocultural aspects of Napa have made it a great place for people who aspire to make great Cabernet can go and potentially thrive quickly compared
mm-hmm.
to other regions. There's a lot of shared knowledge, or used to be a lot of shared knowledge. You,
mm-hmm.
you get that here to a degree, but there's, I think there's, it's not exactly inward looking here
mm-hmm.
in terms of where winemakers' attitudes are. That
mm-hmm.
they're it's not so prosaic as to say, you know, we're sort of brigadoon and we only spring up once every 100 years and we're just concentrating on our own little world. I think that part of things is changing.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that I've tried to help out with younger winemakers is mm-hmm. to emphasize the idea you've got to taste frequently from areas that aren't your own.
Mm-hmm.
In order to learn what's possible out there, in order to see the possibilities
mm-hmm.
Of wine all the beauty and all of just the wonderfulness of different techniques and different growing areas and different varieties. If you're only tasting your wine or your neighbor's wine, you're going to have a very myopic view of the wine world. Mm-hmm. I think that Napa Valley has gotten that. And I think Bob Mondavi, again, going back to him, was one of those guys who was always buying first growth Cabernet to compare Robert Mondavi mm-hmm. Cabernet to. He understood that if we're going to be a world-class growing region, we have to compete against the world. We need to know what the world is doing. Mm-hmm. We're just cracking through that shell right now. You know, we're this little baby bird inside the eggshell, cracking, trying to get out and see that this larger world exists. And it's something I'm really passionate about. Mm-hmm. I drink outside of California practically 100%, in part because I love those wines. I love wines from Italy and France predominantly those countries, Spanish whites, that sort of thing. And these wines offer a lot of teaching mm-hmm. for me as a winemaker. Things to do and things not to do. California wine is the same thing. I'm not a gigantic fan of most of California Cabernet, most of California Bordeaux varieties. Mm-hmm. I think that we've gone past this. Long past. We have gone long past, and a long time ago did we pass this sort of what for me is kind of an envelope of structure that's appropriate for the variety and, mm-hmm. and an envelope of overall mouthfeel, viscosity, all these kinds of winemaking things that render Cabernet Sauvignon, for instance, something that's misshapen and not like, I think, when the wines were more beautiful in the 80s and earlier, when there was a dialed down and more appropriate use of wood mm-hmm. and appropriate sugar levels at harvest and those sorts mm-hmm. of things. I think we've lost a lot of flavors, lost a lot of vineyard specificity mm-hmm. because we're harvesting at 30, some of us are harvesting at 30 yeah. bricks and, you know, using enzymes and things like this that I think don't really get a critical reception, a positive critical perception mm-hmm. and perception, but I look at that as not really understanding what that wine is supposed to do.
Do you think there's hope though? Because it seems to me that yes, and I've heard that from a number of to me very valuable sources, that all the Cabernets, first of all, they age brilliantly. And because of that structure, because of the pyrazines, because of the various elements that populate that wine, they're really testament to how the wines were made with how much integrity. But I think that there's a concerted effort, and I have to credit some of the voices on the production side as well as the trade side, that really is moving the whole notion of what a great Bordeaux blend in this case should look and taste like. So I think there was just this concerted push towards palate pleasing wines. And now it's starting to level off a bit and is perhaps the equilibrium is starting to shift the other direction. What do you think about that?
I think that Wine is a fashion business, mm-hmm. just like fashion is a fashion business, and movies, and there's this pendulum swing that happens every so often. You know, mm-hmm. Chardonnay should be lean, and now Chardonnay should be really oaky and buttery and, mm-hmm. and high in alcohol, but now again it should be lean. These kinds of things happen frequently. Mm-hmm. I think that. That there was a time, I think is past now, for the most part, where there were a very small number of critical voices saying this is the way the wine should be. Mm-hmm. And if the wines are this way, they're going to get really high scores. Mm-hmm. That just reinforces for me what for me is a non-virtuous cycle. Okay. That a winemaker realizing that he or she has to sell wine also is helped by the press who gives a high score to this style of wine. So if I'm smart, I'm going to make that style of wine again because I the points help me to sell wine.
Sure.
There are voices like Randy Dunn, for instance, and Kathy Corzine, who never subscribed to that from a structural standpoint and mm-hmm. and a from the standpoint of volume and gobs of fruit and all, you know, mm-hmm. these things that certain critics really loved. What I see now is that there are so many more voices out there.
Yeah.
You know, there are bloggers and podcasters and merchants and young writers for the major trade publications that have a different view about things, mm-hmm. May have the same view in a way, but those voices don't carry as much weight individually. Mm-hmm. Aggregately, though, I think consumers can look at a lot of different people as mentors in a way.
Yeah.
To help guide, or as guides, to guide them down this road of what wines should I be spending my money on?
Yeah.
Which I think ultimately is a good thing for consumers.
Yeah.
A really good thing for consumers. I think it's a good thing for people who are making wine in small appellations that have, you know, who that haven't gotten the visibility that winemakers in larger appellations, you know, the darling appellations for the press, mainstream yeah. press as it were, have gotten over time. So I think that's a good thing in terms of just opening the world up to more
yeah.
more and different. And I think that it has allowed people maybe to have more success with styles of wine that aren't the same as
right.
the Napa Valley folks tend to make. Although it's not a monolith there
no.
by any stretch. But there is a certain style, I think, that with some subtle differences tends to dominate still.
Well, it seems to me that the world has in fact fundamentally changed in large part due to the digital component and the fact that the information is so much more readily available. It's almost impossible to have a singular voice anymore like they used to be. So what happened is that there's this proliferation of information, and the unfortunate part of it is that the onus is on the consumer, and I think it's quite a bit harder for an average wine drinker of any age, and not assigning generational value to it, to actually understand what is it that they're looking at. So the challenge becomes, how do you communicate succinctly?
That is hard.
I don't think this is going to be an easy interview.
3,675 wineries just in California,
yes.
I think. You know, there's 8,900 in the U.S. or something along those lines. You multiply that by multiple brands for some of these wineries, and you're dealing with thousands and thousands of labels. It's
yeah.
not an easy thing. I drink a lot of wine, and I visit a lot of wine shops, both to sell and to buy. And I see brands from California, proliferating. Like weeds,
yeah.
you know, one day they're there, the next day, you know, you got 10 you never heard of before. And it makes it difficult for the consumer to go into a wine shop without a good retailer to help them along
mm-hmm.
and find something that they can be reasonably sure they're gonna like.
Yep.
I think that's what leads to shopping by price point.
Yep.
Shopping by what the label packaging looks like, shopping by appellation. There are a lot of apps now on your phone you can check out ratings and all that kind of stuff pretty easily if that's something that you like. I don't think that those are tremendously well adopted yet by people.
Mm-hmm.
They say that 90% of the wines that are you know that are bought in supermarkets every day are drunk that day. And so there's I think that there's increasingly the consumer is going in and saying, you know what, I there are too many choices to make. I'm gonna fall back on the one, two or three brands that I know. I don't wanna spend more than $20 or $30 or $40 or $50 mm-hmm. or whatever the number is. I want Cabernet, you know, I've never heard of Livermore Valley. Napa Valley I know, Sonoma I know, I'll just pick something from that section.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it works for them. Often it won't, I think, but it does make it extremely difficult to this long tail idea, you know,
yeah.
where it is something that I think is a reality for people like me,
mm-hmm.
you know, who we make 5,000 cases of wine total.
Mm-hmm.
Gallo makes 76 million cases of wine a year.
Mm-hmm.
The likelihood that somebody picks a bottle of Stephen Kent wine off a shelf who doesn't know who we are at this point in time is very slim. I think. We hope to make it less slim as we use the social media tools out there to tell our story, mm-hmm. to get the word out about the seventh generation now involved in the business, to have fun with wine, which is what wine ought to be, first, last, and middle.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.